Welcome to Florida Matters More, the podcast for Florida Matters, WUSF Public Media's show about the issues and events that Floridians care about. I'm Robin Sessingham, and I host Florida Matters, along with Carson Cooper. I'm here in the studio with Florida Matters producer Stephanie Colombini. Hey, Stephanie.
Hey, Robin.
Also joining us today, Mary Shedden, WUSF News Director.
Hey,
Mary.
Hey, Robin.
You can hear Florida Matters Tuesday evenings at 6:30 and Sunday mornings at 7:30 on WUSF 89.7 or streaming on WUSF.org. You can also hear it Mondays at 10 p.m. on Classical WSMR 89.1 and 103.9. So this week on Florida Matters, we looked at ethnic newspapers in Tampa Bay, including the Weekly Challenger in St. Petersburg, which is an African-American-centered, family-owned newspaper, and Tampa's Spanish-language newspaper La Gazeta, which is approaching the century mark in the Tampa Bay area. The question is, if the big historic newspapers like Tampa Tribune can't make it, how are these guys... how are they making it?
Well,
Mary,
I think what you're looking at is these are publications that are serving a specific community. And you know what? They have a whole lot better chance than what people call the mainstream media or the mass media, because I worked at the Tampa Tribune for 8.5 years, and it was a publication that was geared toward the general audience. That meant everyone from birth to 100 to regardless of where you live, and covering a bunch of areas. So they really didn't target a specific community. So they weren't building the relationship that these publications
and they
really
didn't
can
have
do.
They didn't have their segment of the market. They were competing head-to-head with the St. Pete Times.
Right.
Which, you know, so they're both going for the same thing, whereas these newspapers each have, I would say, their little corner of the market with nobody is competing with, really. Although, you know, there's another African-American paper, I think, in Tampa, probably
right,
is not competing with the one in St. Petersburg.
They are hyper-local, and as Mary mentioned, that relationship. In the show, Lynn Johnson, who's the publisher of the Weekly Challenger, talks about how some people, that she would hear from pastors that, you know, parishioners would tell them the only reason they show up at church every Sunday is to get their copy of the Weekly Challenger. Like, there's that relationship and that bond they have with the publication that some of the more generic mainstream ones, you don't necessarily, they're just a newspaper. They're not your newspaper.
Patrick Mantega, the owner and publisher of La Gazeta, he was saying how they were created almost 100 years ago to fill, to tell the news that wasn't being told elsewhere. And so they immediately were building that relationship with the audience, with people in the community, because they knew they couldn't get that information anywhere else. The Tampa Tribune, the Tampa Bay Times, they weren't telling the stories of the cigar factories in Ybor City. The other thing about La Gazeta, which fascinates me, is that it was printed in three languages. They were reaching out to the Spanish, people who spoke Spanish, Italian, and English, and they actually tout that trilingual label.
Is that
a
because
lot.
It's like the Ybor City kind of cigar culture? Is that
mm-hmm.
because there was also an Italian connection there in Ybor City, or to the cigar industry?
Right.
The Italians came to it was Patrick Mantega's grandfather, I believe, Victoriano, and they said, you know, the immigrants were losing their language and their culture because they had to adapt to kind of the English American way of life and the cultures here in Tampa. So they saw what was going on with the Latin community and said, you know, we want something like that where we can, you know, preserve our culture and keep our spoken language and our written language out there. And so that's why the Mantegas decided to also print in Italian to kind of include them in what they were doing for their own community.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they were saying they didn't want to forget how to read the written Italian language. They said they're speaking the language with their children and their grandchildren, but they wanted to be able to see the language as well. And I found that fascinating. And it makes you want to pick up a copy and look at it and see the language.
I think that what we're getting at is this basically it's niche marketing. You're talking to your community. And I know that the publisher of the Weekly Challenger, the African-American newspaper, was saying we weren't seeing the stories about our community. Well, I was thinking it's true of any community. That's why I think publications that find these niche audiences, whether they're parents or an ethnic group or a geographical group. I had done a story about the Lakelander magazine, which is this beautiful full-color publication in Lakeland. And I thought, you know, with all these print publications dying out, how is it making it? And he, the publisher of that, he's a very experienced publisher in the niche market. He used to publish a magazine about Mustang cars. So it's an interesting market, I think.
Well, and you're going to see that in newspapers, whether it's here in Florida or across the country, is the publications that are surviving as a print product really are those niche publications and really serving an audience as we develop and as the internet becomes this boundless thing. I mean, people are reading the Guardian from the UK every morning if they want to because it's accessible mm-hmm. now. But those niche audiences, those niche communities, their stories are just as important as they were 100 years ago. But these publications know, and if they can figure out how to make it work financially and create that revenue stream, because you know what, there's going to be a coffee shop or a realtor who still wants to put an ad in those publications. And so where else can they go but those markets?
Those local.
Well, and that, I mean, you know, they're surviving, but they're hardly thriving. Even these, you know, in the show, Lynn Johnson says that the Weekly
Challenger.
She's
the publisher of the Weekly Challenger.
You know, advertising is way down and that the bulk of their business is on the internet and they don't make a lot of money on the internet. So, I mean, these publications are surviving, but they're feeling that same, you know, push towards digital that everybody else is feeling, and they're uncertain about how many actual physical copies they'll be circulating in 5-10 years. So they're fighting it out for, you know, the love of the game, but it's not everyone
still
is feeling
a hard
that.
Time. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, you were talking about the fact that these niche markets are making it because people still want to hear what's happening in their neighborhood, and they also want to see pictures. Mm-hmm. We had a publication I lived up in North Florida, and they had a small little paper that came out, and they would publish, I thought it was genius, they would publish all the pictures of the Little League teams. Mm-hmm. Because every parent wants to see a picture of their kid, and they want a hard copy of it.
Yeah.
And so they're going to definitely take those copies of those newspapers. And I was thinking the same thing. I get the Jewish press, and the Jewish press will have pictures of bar mitzvah kids. Mm-hmm. And who doesn't want a picture of, everybody wants a picture of their kid. And the Jewish press will do things just like those for the Black community and the Spanish community. The Jewish press will spend, a lavish 2,000 words on a story about the Florida Israel Business Accelerator, mm-hmm. which might get a mention in the Tampa Bay Times, but it's not going to get 2,000 words. But right. There's people who are interested in those stories and want to see more.
There's the thing about these publications is they are so important to telling the story of a community long term. And one of the things that I really got from the show is I'm sitting there, and as I became a journalist and I heard the phrase, this is the first draft of history. The news stories you read is the first draft of history. We're there to record it. We're not there to do, you know, sometimes we can do analysis down the road, but our job is to tell that story as it's happening. And so when you look at these specialized publications that look at certain communities, if they're not doing it, those stories could be lost. Mm-hmm. And that absolutely terrifies me as a member of any community. And
well, I think Rodney Kite Powell, who is the historian we have mm-hmm. on Florida Matters,
yes.
says a lot of, especially back in the 60s or 70s, you know, if the Weekly Challenger or La Gazzetta hadn't printed stories of what was going on in their communities, it wouldn't have gotten printed.
Right.
You know, not necessarily the readers of the St. Pete Times weren't necessarily interested in the same things, and it would have been lost to history. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, and that idea that the positive stories weren't being told. You could read the St. Pete Times and see that a black person had caused a crime or something like that, but it's the successes and the accomplishments that the community was making.
But that's these niche, you know, a regular paper isn't going to print those, what they call successes. You know, audiences are always saying, where are the good news stories? Where are the good news stories? Well, your regular newspaper is covering the school board meetings and the city council meetings and things like that. They're not necessarily going to put that about any community, what those, you know, the successes that you're talking about, or the fundraisers, which are really important to some communities. In Jewish press, you're going to see a big article about the Jewish Federation fundraiser. I don't expect to see that in the Lakeland Ledger.
Right.
But even like an African-American getting involved in city council or a Hispanic person, you know, making a business decision that impacted the whole community. You know, there are certain stories that aren't just like fluff news stories that even kind of those stories weren't being told in the mainstream newspapers. Now it might, you know, now I'm sure there's a lot more integration and diversity in all coverage, but in the 60s and the 70s, even the political accomplishments of the black community in St. Pete, say, weren't being given the attention that, say, the same accomplishment from a white person would have. That's what we learned
right.
from, you know.
And you're going to find that the stories that were in the mainstream publications at that time were very stereotypical. And the fact is, if you don't live in a community and know a community, your ignorance can show when you're a journalist. And I think that's a real challenge we have, is if you don't know about it, it's hard to write about it and report it. And that is some of the argument of having these publications. But it's also the reason why we want to make sure, as journalists, we're asking questions and making sure we're not making assumptions. And in the 60s and 70s, it was a lot of stereotypes. And, you know, going back to the historical importance of telling the story of a community and the history, one thing I absolutely love is the university, and they mentioned this in the show, the University of Florida and the University of South Florida have been digitizing these niche publications. Well, actually, they've been digitizing all publications. And USF is working on a project with the Weekly Challenger, digitizing whatever copies they can find, because not all are there.
I was just going to say, at least in the 60s. And it might be hard to find those copies in the 60s and 70s, because Lynn Johnson, the publisher, said that her father, who founded the magazine back then, that idea of let's archive this wasn't necessarily there.
Oh, no.
And they got thrown, when the room was full, they got thrown out.
Right.
So she hasn't
even they're missing some of those.
Right, they're searching. And it's an active project. And it was actually—
They didn't have like a morgue like we had in old newspapers.
No.
They didn't have a— I never thought of
that. It was the family business, and you don't.
What are we going to do with all this old stuff?
Right. And so right now, they are literally, if they find a copy, they're trying to get it and digitize it really by word of mouth right now, which I think is a really neat project. But the University of Florida is also digitizing all Florida publications. So you can go back to go on their archive, which is on their library website at the university, and look for publications from the Gainesville Sun, the Florida Times Union, and these niche publications. The college papers are even digitized.
I think I love history things, so I really enjoyed this show. And it was so awesome hearing Rodney Kite Powell, who was the historian, talk about how he himself, as like a young guy, went to the La Gazzetta headquarters or whatever and asked the Mantegas if he could just like hang out there and help archive and, you know, go through old papers. And they're like, who is this white guy that's coming in? And what, you know, but they got to know each other really well. And I had no idea before the show happened. So we learned that during the taping that actually they had a history together, Patrick Mantega and Rodney Kite Powell. And so just that idea of preserving history. And one thing that he points out is that even more valuable than the stories that you see in the physical papers, all the photographs that didn't make it in, you know, for every cover shot, you have 100 rejects, but those are awesome for a historian to know, you know, what was going on back then. So the newspapers and everything that comes along with them are pretty priceless
So where are these? So you said digitized at the University of Florida.
Right, so online.
Like Rodney Kite Powell's, where's the stuff that he was archiving?
Well, so USF Library also,
they have
La Gazzetta.
La Gazzetta has their own. Patrick Mantega says they don't throw anything away. So I think, you know, they've been around almost 100 years. They're missing some of the like really early stuff, but they have, you know, records for decades. And so they keep their own stuff. Yeah, it's all over the place, which is good. And then the digitizing just helps kind of keep it permanent out there so that, God forbid, if, you know, anything happens to the physical copies, it's, you know, it's there.
As a journalist, I'm a little selfish in thinking that I'm so glad these things are being saved and digitized. And I wish every kid who doesn't consume media right now, whether it's listening to the radio or listening to podcasts like this one, that they understood the importance of media as it's happening and wish they consumed it as it was happening, because suddenly they get an assignment, tell me about Ybor City, and all of a sudden they discover the La Gazzetta archives and they're like, wow, I never knew this. Well, you know what? It's not just about history. It's about now. And I think, you know, that's why I'm rooting for groups like the Weekly Challenger and La Gazzetta to thrive into the future as much as us. You know, I think it's critical we keep as many media voices out there that are telling the stories of communities.
Well, here's the last question. This was the big one for me, is that you mentioned they said something about coming to church just to pick up a copy of the newspaper. It was a big reason they're coming to church. And that makes me think, because, you know, a lot of civic institutions are fading away. As you know, we know that fewer people are coming to church or going to civic organizations like Rotary or Kiwanis Club, things like that. So these kinds of publications, do they become more important to people as a gathering place, or are they going to die out also, suffering the same fate as these other civic institutions? What do you think?
I could go either way. I mean, you see that so much is, you know, going digital now, and you're losing physical contact with humans, with, you know, objects. But then you also see that as things go away, then people like miss them more. You know, record players are back, Polaroids, you know, so maybe that's could happen, where, you know, you might realize, oh my gosh, the Weekly Challenger, I haven't seen a copy in forever. And then all of a sudden, that's the hot thing to grab at the vintage store or wherever. And it sort of makes a resurgence. So,
I hope so.
I'm just thinking, though, if you're not going to church and you're not feeling a sense of that tight community anymore, maybe your interest in the stories goes away also.
I think that's where social media comes in. And I think Lynn Johnson from the Weekly Challenger really gets it. She said, you know, we're going to continue our newspaper. We're going to continue the printed copy so it shows up at church. But she's on Facebook. And I follow the Weekly Challenger on Facebook. And it's an active site. And the conversations are happening there. And so the important thing is that she sees that newspaper's role as being a voice for the community to come together, and she's going where the people are. And the fact is, they're on social media. And heck, we're doing that as well as WUSF. And I think that's the responsibility of journalists and the media, is to keep our job is to create that, be the place where conversation can happen.
And from a business side, I think that's the question, is will the industry sort of adapt? Because right now, the Weekly Challenger is on social media. And she said, actually, even more so than visiting theweeklychallenger.com or whatever and looking at the newspaper that way, they go to Facebook first. But as Patrick Mantega with La Gazzetta pointed out on the show, there's not really any money in being on social media. So, you know, the question is, do you start, I don't know, subscribing, you know, like us on Facebook and pay to actually view this piece, you know, view this article, or advertising, you know, is that going to change and get more involved? There's got to be some way that financially somehow the business stays afloat, because the desire to provide the content is there, the content's there, the audience that appreciates it is there, but as always in life, money gets in the way.
If you look at the hyper-local publications, it's a local realtor, it's a local restaurant that isn't going to get any you know, that depends on foot traffic. Those are the kind of places that are going to still advertise in print products. But the fact is, you've got to figure out that online model because that's where the audience is.
Thanks for joining us. Listen to Florida Matters Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. and Sunday mornings at 7:30 a.m. on WUSF 89.7. You can always find it online at WUSF.org. Come back next week for another episode of Florida Matters More and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher.